Welcome to Leadership Conversations with Nikki Gumbel. Today, Nikki talks with Shelby and Jordy Shedd, who give an open and powerful insight into navigating life and faith together through thick and thin. Shelby will be speaking live at Leadership Conference 2024 on 6th to the 7th May at the Royal Albert Hall.
Shelby and Jordy, welcome. Lovely to see you. And we're really excited about you coming to speak at the Leadership Conference on the 6th and 7th of May. So I'd love to, for people who don't know you, to hear a little bit about both of your stories. How long have you actually known each other? You're married? How long have you been married now?
We just celebrated 10 years last week.
Wow.
Yeah. 10 years.
10 years. We've known each other since we were 17 and 18.
Yeah, high school.
I'm a little older, so I was 18 and Jordan was 18.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Shelby, I know that you come from a middle child of a family of five. And in high school, you were a two-sport varsity athlete. Just say what that. What is a two-sport varsity athlete? And what were two sports?
You know, I grew up at a private Christian school. So being a two-sport athlete at a small, tiny private Christian school doesn't mean that much. But I grew up in a very athletic family. Jordan's very athletic himself. I played softball. And I was a golfer as well in high school. So primarily softball. And then post-diagnosis, playing softball got to be a bit too challenging. So I switched over to golf.
And Jordy, what are your sports?
So I played soccer growing up, football, as you'd call it. And so played soccer growing up and then lacrosse as well. So those were the two sports.
Okay.
For me.
And are you still playing sport?
No. not beyond a pickup game here and there, and you know, all the fun that way. So,
yeah, because you're a worship leader, full time worship leader.
Yeah, so right now I'm overseeing our creative team at the church, and then a worship leader as well. So,
and which church is that?
So we're at a Jesus Church in Portland, Oregon.
A Jesus Church. Yeah.
Okay. So so that's the sport, and you've both been Christians since the year dot, haven't you?
Yeah, we're so grateful to have been raised in really wonderful families that gave us both a really strong foundation in Jesus. So, yeah.
So, Shelby, going back to your you were crowned homecoming queen. What does that mean? What does that mean? For a British audience, explain homecoming queen is.
Homecoming queen just means basically you... I don't know, glorified popularity contest, maybe?
That's amazing.
How would you describe this? Such an interesting idea.
Basically, your class votes on who gets to be homecoming queen and king. And then it was for our basketball homecoming. And so then you get very dressed up and walk the basketball court and, you know, spotlight the whole nine yards.
It's a thing.
You were class president 2 years running.
Yes, sir. So,
and again, what does that mean, class president?
Is it like the school? You know, great question.
Would you call it a school prefect here or something? Head girl.
Yes, head girl. We'll go with that.
And then at 16, something very life-changing happened. Just for those who don't know your story, say what happened to you at 16. If you're happy to do so.
Absolutely. So like we've mentioned, grew up in a really active and athletic home. And as I was getting ready for the summer softball season, we were in winter conditioning, and I just started to notice that things were not quite feeling right in my body, and things that weren't normal for me started to happen. So I just started to feel really slow. To get to all of my classes, you have to go up 3 flights of stairs, and I would get to the top and just look around and be like, is everyone else having as hard of a time as I am? Like, why is this so hard? And then, you know, I'd be just having normal conversation standing up and then fall over and just lose my balance. And so the falling started to happen too frequent to just blame it on being a klutz. And so I went to my mom and, you know, explained what was going on. And quickly we started seeing specialists. And right from that first appointment, the doctor, whose name ironically was Dr. Gabriel, She just was like, I'm pretty sure that you have something called muscular dystrophy. It's going to take a while to see if that's what's really going on. But sure enough, about after 6 months of a muscle biopsy and lots of different tests, they were able to clearly identify that I had something called limb girdle muscular dystrophy, which is a type of disease that is progressive in nature. And so it's a genetic disease that means that all of the muscles in my limbs just slowly deteriorate over time. So currently there's no treatment, no cure. And yeah, I got that news when I was 16 that, yeah, I was a bit on borrowed time as far as my body's ability to keep up with my pace of life that I was operating at that time. And that continues to be true today.
And yeah. did you have a relation, a cousin or someone who was who had the same condition?
Yeah, that's right. So it was a bit shocking to just hear initially at that first appointment that I probably had muscular dystrophy. It's a very rare disease. And so, not a lot of people know what it is, but that wasn't true for my family. Because like you said, I had a cousin who had it. He had a very severe type of muscular dystrophy. And my mom had been a primary caretaker at different seasons of his life. So she was acutely aware of what that diagnosis looked like practically, because she had seen it up close and personal. And so we were very aware of like, oh, this is a really big deal. This has massive implications for how I would live and operate in everyday life. And so it was quite shocking. Yeah.
Was your cousin a lot older?
Yeah. So I'm 30. And there's about a probably 15-year difference, 15, 20 years. So I grew up watching him navigate life in a wheelchair and navigate just the reality of how life can be and how both wonderful and challenging it can be. You know, he went on to get married and had two wonderful sons. But unfortunately, when he was 40, it was just, the disease had really taken a toll and he passed away when he was 40.
Okay.
And so that was a great tragedy that our family walked through. And so, this is like muscular dystrophy was something that wasn't just, a Google description. It had a face, it had a name, it had a story already.
Yeah.
And so it was wild to, as a 16-year-old start to understand and unpack what that might look like and mean for me.
And Jordy, you knew Shelby, when you met her, you knew that she had this condition.
He
definitely knew. I had had my heart broken before, and so when I met Jordan and I thought that, oh, there might be something here, poor guy, our first date, I sit him down and I'm like, listen, if you see your, we're 17 and 18, but I'm like, if you want kids or if you want a wife who can walk into your future next, you should find someone else and, you could share this, but.
Yeah, I was like about to ask her out to go out and, my older brother is, he was in med school at the time. And so I actually got to chat with him a little bit about the disease and some of those things. And so she came to me with all these like, hey, if you want X, Y, and Z. And I was like, I wouldn't have asked you out on a date if I hadn't at least, I still have to figure all that out. But I am aware of what's going on in the reality of your situation. And stuff.
So you had sort of researched that before you asked her out.
Yeah, I could not. I feel like that would be pretty hard.
It was pretty sweet. He was like, I sat down with my older brother who is in med school and he told me everything that there is to know about your situation. And he was just like, if I didn't sense that God was in this, I would have never asked you out. And so, it was a moment for us for sure. Yeah.
And so you asked her out, and then how long was the relationship before you got married?
3.5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So You know, we met at a time where everyone tells you not to start dating. So it was the summer before I was leaving for college out of state, and Jordan was headed into senior year of high school. Yeah. So just, you know, not great timing to start a relationship. But again, we just sensed that there was something
there.
And so we started dating and had a really sweet dating relationship, 3.5 years. And then we ended up moving out to Southern California to pursue our undergrad studies at Biola University. And again, you know, people say most of the time, you should wait until you graduate college, you know, to start a marriage. And we were like, no, we'll just start now. So we got married when we were 20 and 21. Yeah. And, you know, we just had a sense of like, you know, if the nature of my disease is very progressive, we want to, and we know that we feel a calling on our life to do life together, might as well start now. Yeah. And so we feel really grateful for that decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Still 10 years later, and feel very grateful.
And so, Jordy, in the last 10 years, just say a bit about what you, because have you, did you always been a worship leader? Is that something that you've moved into, or has that always been the your kind of a sense of calling?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, really, the plan was to become a dentist. My dad is a dentist. Okay. He owns a practice in Kentucky. And so in worship leading, music was not the thing that I was expecting.
It was a part of
it. It was a part of my life, but it wasn't like
a part of your career goals.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. And so it was my senior year of high school where I really felt like pretty strongly, like, I feel like ministry is actually the thing that I want to step into. And just some specific moments had with some mentors and people like that as well that were encouraging that and could see that and call that out in me, which was really huge. And then, just stepped into worship leading. I didn't sing or lead, you know, anything like that until I was a junior in high school and then senior in high school. And so it kind of just evolved from there and became a thing. And so, yeah, songwriting has become a huge part of my life. I love just capturing the heart of God and melody and different things like that for the church and for people and also other things as well. So it's become, a lot of basically what I'm doing now is helping oversee all of the creative things that are happening in the church and then worship leading. So it's been a joy and I love it. So it's been a journey though. Definitely wasn't the thing that I was like, I'm going to do this, you know, and then the Lord kind of grabbed a hold of my heart and it's been a really sweet discovery.
And it's been really sweet for us. Jordan has a real gifting as it relates to writing songs. But a lot of those songs are prayers that have come out of our life or prayers that our church is praying. And so I think it's been really significant in our journey of lament, of grief, of joy, of celebration, to actually put those prayers to melody and lyric has been quite powerful and significant for us, I feel like, in our journey.
So I've seen you singing You're All I Need. Is that a song you wrote or is that a...
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing.
The first one,
actually. The first songs I wrote and recorded. I mean, I've been, you know, as a writer, you're always writing, and I'm sure you can know that you're always writing, doing something. And then some of the things that you get to write are the things that get to eventually come to life.
And just say a little bit about that. Jesus, You're All I Need. I mean, that's quite a thing. To say.
Yeah, I think that song specifically, I started writing that with a really good friend of mine who I still write music with all the time. We're in a band together. And that song specifically came out of a season where we had been, you know, doing a lot of different things, especially in ministry. We'd been trying to create a lot of different moments and events and things like that. And so that first verse of that song specifically is like, I've tried to build something of no worth. And it's just kind of like this undoing of a way of ministry, undoing a way of a relationship that I thought that like God was like, I need all these things from you. And so a bit of like a song of repentance, but then it turns into a song of like declaration when it's like, yeah, you're all I need. And it's almost like a repenting God, like, I'm sorry that I've lost that. And then also at the same time, an invitation to like really prioritize that and actually proclaim that as a church and as for me personally, it's you're all I need. Yeah. Because I think we've maybe experienced that in different ways as well. Just navigating life with disability and things. I think we've just experienced a bit of the stripping.
The freeing of attachments, I'd say.
Yeah.
When you're one of the gifts that I think suffering can invite you into is increased dependence. And then you realize that, man, when you put Jesus at the center, when he becomes your all in all, it makes a big difference. You need it. You need him.
And Shelby, your sense of calling. So you leave what we'd call university, I think we call college, whatever.
Yeah.
What did you do after that? What did you study at university? What did you both study?
We actually both studied Bible and theology.
Yep.
Okay.
And so that's what we got our undergrad in. And okay. I've had such an interesting relationship with the, you know, the conversation around calling and vocation and things like that. I look back on my life, and for whatever reason, from a really young age, I just had like a desire to read the Bible, understand the Bible, and then was given really wild opportunities to get to like speak and lead my peers. Like my youth pastors were so empowering, and they, I think, saw something in me that I didn't quite have eyes to see at the time. But from the time I was in middle school, it just called out like, we see this gifting in you to read and teach the scriptures.
Middle school would be what age?
Yeah, I was 11, 12, 13.
Oh, wow. So you were kind of preaching from 11.
Yeah.
11 onwards.
Was given these little opportunities here and there,
that's
too.
True.
Yeah.
Stand up and share what God was revealing to me about himself through the word. And so I think that started to stoke that fire and desire to understand and, you know, communicate the character and beauty of Jesus and the gospel. And then right after my diagnosis, was given a whole lot more opportunities to speak and to, you know, talk about the reality of choosing and seeking God in the midst of confusion, in the midst of pain and things like that. And so, I was platformed, I'd say, like from a pretty young age. And then when I actually entered into college, I felt a real sense of God saying, like, say no, say no to opportunities,
okay.
Say no to, you know, different, opportunities to speak here and there. And I felt like it was an invitation to really lock eyes and center in on his presence, like to learn how to prioritize his presence, and not always attach it to a platform. And that was a really significant season for me. And so kind of connected to that, you know, I do my undergrad, I had a wonderful undergrad experience. And then, my first job in ministry was actually being a second grade coordinator at a church. And I just sensed the Lord saying, like, if you can't take, you know, these big truths and conversations that you've been having throughout these last 4 years and communicate the simple gospel to a second grader, what are you doing? And so it was a really formidable season for me, to preach the simple gospel that is still just as powerful and important to second graders, you know.
And so what now, right? What's the main thing that you do, and is it a lot of speaking?
Yeah, good question. So right now I am bivocational, and so I work part-time at our church, a Jesus church, and I help oversee our teaching team and our Sunday gatherings. And so Jordan and I kind of get to collaborate, and I primarily get to oversee how we communicate vision, how we host God's presence, so that we don't just create, you know, a gathering where people hear about Jesus, but is actually creating space for them to experience Jesus. And so that's what I get to do at the church. I'm on our teaching team, and so I teach once or twice a month there. And then about 2 years ago is when I really sensed God saying, hey, I've got more. But I need you to create the margin in order to step into that. And I didn't really know what that meant, but I just sensed the only clear step was like, okay, I think I actually need to go part-time in order to maybe show up to some of these other things that God is wanting me to step more fully into. And so did that. And then my first opportunity when I made that decision to go part-time was actually speaking in Florida at the Alpha Conference. And it's kind of just, it's kind of just evolved to getting to speak in different contexts, churches, conferences. And then the other part of that world for me is also getting to do some writing. And so I have a really wonderful writing partner, Ben Woodman, who is the host of the Youth Alpha series. And he's kind of just taken me under his wing. And so we get to partner and collaborate on a lot of different projects specifically that help young people understand the foundations of the Christian faith. We've gotten to do some work with Emotionally Healthy Spirituality with Pete Scazzaro in making some of that content available and applicable to young people. And so, yeah, that's a little bit of what I'm up to.
Yeah. So seeing you two at the conference, I was so moved. I mean, seeing Jordan carry you onto the stage, it was such a powerful moment. I mean, for both of you, the fact that the challenges that both of you have faced in the last, whatever it is, 10 years, 12 years, 14 years, I guess, for you, Shelby. And I've heard you talk about power in weakness. Mm-hmm. Just say a little bit about what have you learnt in that leaders listening to this can learn from your experience, because we all face challenges in life, but very few face quite as big a challenges as you two have faced.
Yeah, I think a truth that we hear a lot in circles like these is that God meets you where you are. But I think the thing that I've been learning is that if I'm not being honest about where I am, then it makes it really challenging for God to actually meet me where I am and therefore experience the power and peace of his presence in that place. And so, you know, I think we are both wired in certain ways to want to sidestep our emotions, to want to sidestep the reality of like pain and suffering. And I think that is the human experience to some extent. It's quite challenging to actually sit in and allow yourself to feel the grief that you're experiencing over a particular situation. And I think for us, it's been learning that actually when we name and when we notice the hard stuff of life, when we get honest about our need, that creates this really palpable opportunity to experience the comfort and the power of God's presence. And one of the things that I notice about Gen Z is that they are a generation that longs for something real, that longs for authenticity. Yeah. And what is more real than Jesus? Right. Yeah. And so I see this in this generation, and I receive it as an invitation to be real, to be authentic, because in that place, God meets me. And when I show up to young people from that place, it creates an opportunity for them to meet him. You know, Paul talks about this. I think it's 2 Corinthians 2, where he says, I showed up in weakness. Yeah. I showed up in weakness and dependence so that you might experience the power of and the demonstration of the Holy Spirit. Yeah. I think that Jesus talked about this, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Yeah. You know, it's like when you actually know your need, when you lean into the reality of your weakness and your need for God, man, it creates this incredible opportunity to walk in the power of his presence. And that's not an easy journey. I mean, we could tell loads of stories.
If anything, maybe we've been forced into it more than you know. And I think, but at the same time, having to be confronted with that on a like monthly, regular basis, we've just been having to learn along the way that truth, maybe in a very real reality for our lives.
Yeah, and because the boundary lines of my disability are always changing. Yeah. Things are, I'm always in this state of realizing what I, you know, another thing that I can't do, you know, and that, you know, just to be super honest, you know, I'm in a space now where for a lot of years when I would fall over, I'd be able to like jimmy rig a situation where I could then get back up. But just in the last couple of months, we've literally found ourselves in a situation where I'm at home, I've fallen, and I can't get up. And, you know, I have to crawl my way to a phone to call Jordan, and then he's got to come. And that is just, you know, it's hard.
Yeah.
And I think it continues to be an invitation to meet with Jesus in the midst of that. And experience him as our anchor, as the one that, you know, we need.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, obviously it's so hard for you, Shelby, but Jordi, it's also to see your wife suffering and is such a hard thing. And how do you cope with that?
It's a great question. I'm in counseling right now. And so, so a lot of my, I realized in a lot of this that, positivity is a strategy. It's not an emotion. And I'm a positive person. And so a lot of my coping has been, through positivity, which I don't think is inherently bad or anything. But it has been a season where we've had to kind of step into that space. I've had to step into that space more personally, to actually have space to grieve differently. Coping for me looks like writing, looks like working out, looks like doing things, you know, so there's a lot of different things I think that coping specifically looks like, but that was a pretty big insight for me with the idea that positivity is a strategy and not an emotion. And for me to realize that I can so quickly, and even with different people, not even just Shelby, but different people in the church, it's so easy to just like positivity or come in with like, but God's going to do this amazing thing or whatever. And to not take the moment to be with a person, in the midst of that pain, in the midst of those things, I just see Jesus doing that so much. And then that in some ways is even the healing before the, maybe a physical miracle, or the thing. It's just the dignifying some of those things. But then it's like, he loves us enough to meet us there, but then also not enough to just leave us in that space. And he wants to pull us into the thing that he has. So I think for me personally, it's been a journey of
showing up. I think something that we noticed really early on in our marriage is if we don't actually stop to grieve, to literally cry with one another for one another, then we actually disconnect ourselves from being able to experience the beauty and the joy and the power of what this life that includes disability can lead us into. And so we really can't waste time trying to numb out or trying to sidestep,
which I've been guilty of, reality. You know,
we all are. Yeah.
But I feel like that has been one of the things that we've even been learning. I've been learning. I think the freedom of like, the freedom from death is like an invitation into like life. And so we've been kind of, as we're experiencing these slow, like little micro
deaths
along the way, it's been almost an invitation into some of the freedom of those fears or from those different things. And in that, God's just been doing a really cool work and like redemptive work of life as well. So it's been that weird hyper, you know, hards, lows, highs. And so, definitely a journey, I would say, for me specifically.
And Shelby, for what are the things that that you pass on to other people about coping with real difficulties in life? What are the things that because I think people will give great weight to what someone who's experienced what you've experienced. What are the things that you have found in the last 14 years? What are the what are the things that you would say to other people who are maybe not in exactly the same situation, but maybe coping with a lot of pain in their life and struggles and difficulties and bereavement and loss and pain and suffering? What are the things that you've can pass on?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's lots, like we've kind of touched on, that we've learned by not you know, bypassing the pain. One of the gifts of growing up in the home that I grew up in was that, you know, I grew up with a strong foundation and understanding of the truth of God's character, which is consistent, which is constant, regardless of your circumstances. But one of the things that did me a disservice was thinking that the response to anything hard needed to first and automatically be, but I trust in God and it's all going to be okay. you know, that is true. I do believe that. But when I don't allow myself to feel and confront the reality of pain and sorrow and grief, then that truth mostly just lives in my head. It doesn't actually sink into the reality of my heart and my life. And so I've had to do a lot of learning and practice around paying attention to what I'm actually feeling so that I can move through it instead of trying to go around it, trying to bypass it, trying to ascend it in some ways through spiritual truths. And so I think that's been a big thing.
How do you do that? How do you do that? How do you confront that? And how do you express it? And how do you deal with that?
Literally stopping. So I have to literally take time daily, weekly, you know, depending on the season and what I'm experiencing. It looks really practically like stopping. So sitting still, it looks like silence and solitude with the Lord, and just trying to really get curious with what I'm experiencing. Yeah. So trying to drop the judgment, trying to drop any shame that I might be experiencing, and actually exercise compassion and curiosity towards myself and what I'm experiencing, and then name the things. So journaling's been really helpful and key for me to actually like name and identify, God, this is what I'm feeling. This is what I'm experiencing. And, you know, the scriptures talk about how we have a high priest who is able to empathize with us in every way. That stopping and naming what we're experiencing is creating space for him to empathize with us and to actually enter into greater intimacy with Jesus in the midst of what we're experiencing. That truth actually becomes real. It becomes grounded in reality when we stop to actually name and process what it is we're feeling with Jesus. So I think that's been a big thing that I would want to encourage people into.
Yeah.
Because again, it anchors us in dependence. It actually strips us of this lie and illusion of control and strength in and of our own selves, you know? I think again, Paul talks about this power made perfect in weakness.
Yeah.
That we have to slow down and stop in order to actually receive and walk in the power of that presence, which is the Holy Spirit. And then the other big thing that I feel like I've been learning lately, one of the things that I feel like suffering is teaching me is, I think for a lot of my late teenage years and 20s, I felt this, you know, clock on life. Kind of this mentality of like, okay, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to do this. So I'm going to do it with everything that I have, everything that I can. We're going to, you know, show up to everything fast and furious in some ways. Mm-hmm. But at the root of that is this scarcity mentality. It's this feeling of like, you know, I've got to do because, you know, the clock is ticking and I don't know how much longer I have. And that creates this like low grade anxiety and scarcity mentality that you kind of live with. And I really sense God's invitation to be free from that, to recognize that actually as a believer, you don't just live one life. You know, like the life you live now, the kingdom of heaven is here and now. And so you can actually show up to this life in such a way that reaps a fruit and a harvest in the life to come, in both this life and the life to come. And so it's really changed my understanding and relationship to time, to recognize that death, both like the death, the actual death of our lives, and then all of the little deaths that we experience in this life can actually be an invitation into greater perspective. And there is so much peace that comes with that kingdom perspective. It anchors you, I think, in this life in such a way where you can really live because you don't fear what's coming.
Yeah.
You know, it strips it of its fear and its power.
Thinking of that Matthew verse, for what saves his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And so I think that there's been that, maybe that juxtaposition or that pull back and forth with like, oh wow, losing these aspects of life, but then having the perspective shift and you're like, wow, we're actually being able to enter into life more fully because of, it's like, we're not living in the illusion that we're not, you know, that we don't have an end.
We're all dying.
Like, like, and it's a thing we all want to avoid.
Yeah.
We all want to run from it at all costs. Yeah. And if anything, our culture is trying to help us do that at all costs. And And I think sometimes when you have to be confronted time and time again, it almost makes you have to tear down the idol of self-preservation time and time again. And then you get to experience Jesus in that as well, which is cool.
Yeah, and it's true of everyone. One of our former vicars, who was in his 80s, went to see the doctor, and the doctor said to him, you know, you could die at any moment. And he said to the doctor, and so could you, which the doctor had to admit. The doctor had to admit was true. You know, any of us can die at any moment. But so we nobody knows, do they? But one of the things I love that you said, that I've heard you say, I think quoting Brené Brown about vulnerability, that your vulnerability is something we really admire in other people, but we don't like to do ourselves. That's certainly true of me. I'm so impressed when people are vulnerable, but I find it really hard to be vulnerable myself. But you it have is. Been, you know, one of the things I think is so impressive is you two have been so vulnerable and talking about, and I and you've talked about how you really hit a sort of almost a burnout quite early on, I think. So just say if you're happy. I don't want to push you into vulnerability.
But, no, that's quite all right. I mean, this was about 5 years ago now, which it does not feel like five years ago. But, you know, I think a lot of that spiritual bypassing caught up to me because it always does, right? When you don't show up honestly to where you are and what you're feeling and experiencing, it doesn't mean that it just goes away. It lives in your body. It lives in you and then comes out sideways often. And so when we were transitioning, we both grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. After we graduated from college, we went back to Kentucky to work for a season. And then we moved out to Portland about a year and a half later. So this was about our year into putting down roots here in Portland.
2018.
And I was just having a really hard time with that transition. And it was complex. You know, there's a lot of layers to this story, but it's like one layer of that was the reality of living in a new culture. The Pacific Northwest is really different than the South, the Bible Belt of the South. The weather is different. So there's this, you know, climate layer. There's the relational layer of like, you're getting to know, you feel like you're in kindergarten again, where it's like, you have to walk up and be like, will you be my friend? And so there's just this relational component. And then it was also a season in my life where things were progressing really quickly. And I was just hitting new milestones in the reality of navigating life with disability, all in a new place. And and so that was a lot. But and I, on top of that, was experiencing some really acute trauma in my family. We had a couple of really young people in my family pass away suddenly. And so there's lots of layers, but I just hit this point where, you know, I had never quite experienced you know, clinical anxiety before, but I was in a space where anxiety took over and it manifested itself in insomnia. So all of a sudden it's like, I can't sleep. Everything that I feel like used to just come so easily to me, is taking me forever to do. And I had a moment where, you know, I was supposed to be teaching at youth and I walked into work and I just lost it and had to leave because the anxiety, you know, I was having a panic attack and it was humiliating. And that kind of was the tipping point into a really, really hard season of life for us. And, you know, growing up in the way I did, the way that I tried to handle that was just try harder and be better. I just thought if I just worked harder or was better in some way, then I would be able to get out of the season I was in. And that didn't work for me. It just made it worse. And so ultimately it got to a space where it was too much for Jordan and I to handle on our own. I needed help, you know. Here I was, a youth pastor, and I'm struggling with intrusive thoughts. I'm struggling with suicidal ideation. I'm struggling with self-harm. And I just, the shame of feeling like such a hypocrite in the midst of that was so heavy. And so ultimately, we had to make a really hard decision where I needed some serious help. And so I ended up doing an inpatient program in Tennessee at a place called OnSite. I did the Milestones program there, which is a 30-day inpatient program trauma rehab facility. And they were wonderful. And but that season was hard. I mean, I ended up actually staying for 40 days, completely isolated from my family. I had 1 hour of visitation time every Sunday for 1 hour. And Jordan was still living in Portland. He would fly every week to spend 1 hour with me. He flew from Portland to Tennessee to spend 1 hour. And it was just a, you know, a really gnarly time, really gnarly season where we weren't sure what was going to happen. And ultimately, I had to get to a place again where it's like you had getting to the root for me was realizing like, oh man, I think some of the prayers I had been praying for a lot of my life were like, Lord, please let me die young because I don't actually want to experience life with a disability. Like if life with disability looks like this, I'm really not so sure I want to live it. And ultimately that's what was coming out in that season. And I was trying to sidestep it by being really good at my job, you know, being really excellent in ministry, having a really wonderful marriage. And those band-aids aren't enough to cover that deep wound, that deep grief. And so that season and time was humiliating. I had, you know, I had to take a leave of absence from work. You know, it was a very, very hard time and season of our lives. But ultimately, I think getting to the root of that, getting to the root of like, you know, I'm trying to cope with having a disability by not being too disabled. There's an irony in that. And I had to really move into a space of acceptance of like, okay, this is reality. And I think that when we disconnect ourselves from reality, it just brings about more pain and suffering. And so, that was a season of having really, of needing to really show up and get honest about what I was feeling and what I was experiencing.
And then even the healing journey of coming back to, I mean, I remember we would go back and forth, you know, and then came back to Portland and we had a lot of friends show up at the airport and stuff and just being able to like welcome you back specifically.
Yeah. Because I mean, to be honest, like that season was so hard and people were so confused. I mean, just imagine you have a coworker who you see every day and things seem good and all of a sudden she's gone. And it's like, what's happening? Mm-hmm. And so I think, again, our human tendency is to want to just start over. And Jordan and I were really considering, you know, should we just move back home, start over and just think about Portland as a distant memory, you know, but a nightmare.
But it did feel like, I mean, I remember specifically on one of the flights where the spirit was just like, I don't think that's the journey. I don't think as I was coming home, it was, it almost felt like an invitation, to slowly integrate back into our life and the things that in our friendships and the things, because it felt like an invitation into like the rest of the healing journey.
Yeah.
Rather than just running from like the restoration out of that pit, it was actually like an invitation to go through that with people that knew us, loved us, were going to be there. And honestly, the gift from the church being patient with that process, leaders being intentional with that. I mean, it redeemed even some of my own belief in the church and what the church can actually be when it's at its most beautiful. And so,
definitely. There was a gift in staying when it was hard instead of leaving. I was just reading something recently and the guy was talking about the church as a family. And how oftentimes when we hit conflict, we want to run. We do run, you know, and how, you know, people who stay grow, people who leave don't. And that has been very true for us since coming out of that season.
And looking at your marriage, it's you look, I mean, it's just I've got so much admiration for you both, but also it has so much joy in seeing you together. What have you learned about just marriage and how you support each other in all these difficult times and stuff. Jordan, start with you. What have you learned? What are the secrets of
man?
Secrets of marriage. What are they?
You know, I do have the beauty and the blessing of coming from a lineage of really beautiful marriages. So my grandparents really always modeled friendship really well. I think of my grandparents and they would always take an hour out of their day when they get back from work, whether it was like a cocktail hour or just time to be on the couch together, and they would just catch up and they would just hear about each other's life. And so I was just modeled friendship from a young age. And I think that's something that that we have really tried to embody, and something that is true of our marriage, which is really fun. And I think just the beauty of marriage is being like, I think of seasons where she's like supporting and like leaning into the dreams that I have, and there's seasons where I'm supporting and leaning into the dreams that she has. And it's this beautiful back and forth partnership and friendship. And so I think that's something that we're experiencing even now in a different way. I think you have, I mean, we've had to be forced into partnership in some ways. Like,
physically. I mean, there's not really much I can do alone. And so we go to the grocery together. We clean together. You know, Jordan literally helps me put on my clothes, you know, there's a gift in that, you know, as hard as that is sometimes, there's a gift in that. And I think for me, one of the gifts, again, of navigating life with disability is you don't take life for granted. Hmm. You know, every season and moment feels like a gift, because you know that it could change any moment. It will change.
Yeah.
And I think that translates into the way that we see and care for one another, is to not take it for granted, you know. To not take for granted the gift of getting to do this life together. And so I think when you have that mutual like appreciation and respect for one another, there's a lot of joy, and there's a lot of like, goodness that comes from that. So anything else you would add?
I don't know.
Bestie?
I don't know. I'm like, we have, it is beautiful. I think, I love our marriage, and I know a lot of friends are going through hard times and hard things in marriage and stuff like that too right now. And I consider that such a privilege, and I'm so grateful for that. Yeah. But that's not because it's been easy. If anything, it's because we've been willing to go to those different places together, stare each other's own stuff down, and have hard conflicts when we need to, and not just like let things sift and just sit, but also be really kind to each
other. Nikki, you say this so well. I think that, where did I hear you talk about that? This, like, the first to forgive is the happiest. What do you say?
I mean, forgiveness is very key. I mean, a good marriage is too good for givers, really, I think.
And we have learned that. Quick to forgive.
But honestly, you two are so inspiring, and that what you've described is so beautiful and so I mean, you exude goodness and joy and the Holy Spirit in your lives, and we're so excited that you're coming to the Leadership Conference, and I can't wait to hear your talk, Shelby. It'll be, I know it'll so be good. A highlight of the conference.